WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Trump signs an executive order pushing back his threatened new tariffs from tomorrow to 7 days later. Mexico gets a 90-day extension, but Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says
Mexico is still paying tariffs. They're paying a 25% tariff on fentanyl, 25% tariff on cars, a 50% tariff on steel.
After several inches of rain, flash flood warnings have been in effect from Maryland up to Connecticut. CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson.
This is going to be flooding over places that have already seen flooding this summer. So the ground is already saturated, and they certainly don't need more rain.
People and objects flying through the air. That's how one Delta passenger describes what happened when a flight from Salt Lake City to Amsterdam hit severe turbulence, prompting a landing in Minneapolis and 25 people hospitalized. CBS's Chris Van Cleef.
Everyone is out of the hospital tonight. Delta thanked first responders and says it is cooperating with the NTSB and FAA in their investigations.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers lose to the Cubs.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports.
The Brewers with a 10-3 loss to the Cubs.
A rough day on the mound for Brewers pitchers. A bright spot was the Brewers' William Contreras. Hit his first home run in 6 weeks and then hit another. Pat Murphy.
William can hit, and when you have high expectations and you've been as good as he's been and you're trying to build your career and all the things that come with it, sometimes you go through stretches of not hitting as many homers. Obviously a great sign when he hits one to left field and then one to right field.
NFL Packers back on the practice field for training camp. On Saturday, it'll be inside Lambeau Field for family night. Nearly sold out. What's that experience like for the rookies?
For the rookies, they get to experience that for the first time. You know, running out in the Lambeau, feeling the crowd and the environment for the first time that, you know, you don't want to give them that warning. You want them to experience that. But it's special. You know, it's a fun night to be able to go out there, have a practice in the stadium. Pretty cool deal. You know, I don't know how many other teams do stuff like that, so it's fun.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. You know, as our country politically reels from Trump's chaos, we are falling further behind because, well, years of failing to invest, years of the kind of crazy politics has given the opportunity to the rest of the world to look somewhere else. And the rest of the world isn't waiting politely for us to get our you-know-what together. Nowhere is it clearer than when you look at innovation, infrastructure, and our vanishing global stature. While Trump promises America first, the reality is it's America falling behind. We're hollowing out here at home, shoving away our allies and ceding tomorrow's breakthroughs to whomever might be hungry enough to seize them. And shocker of all shockers, it's China, only too happy to fill the void. What's the Trump doctrine? Well, slash federal dollars for science, starve infrastructure, enrich billionaires, brag about tariffs, while China, well, they're building the world's biggest dams. They're cornering energy technology. They're cornering rare earth minerals, AI, chip manufacturing, you name it, they're grabbing onto it because, well, we've got a president who has proudly turned his back on the international scene, especially on climate. Pulled us out of the Paris Accord, trashes scientific partnerships, and then acts like this is some kind of big win for American sovereignty. It isn't. It's a forfeiture. It's handing all of this over to Beijing. And while American companies fret about tariffs and shrinking markets and all that, China's shaking hands. They're cutting deals, man. They're holding Belt and Road summits. They're building literal bridges from Asia to Africa and Europe. But when, you know, you've got Trump running around bullying our allies, treating NATO like it's some kind of protection racket, and South Korea like a deadbeat tenant, and all of those old promises that we've made as a country, they've gone, evaporated. And understand, the world isn't going to stand around and wait for our melodrama to conclude. Russia's moving into Europe, China's moving basically everywhere, and we're just kind of sulking. Tweets, truths, and, you know, more tariffs. That's not going to help us rebuild our infrastructure and our manufacturing base. We used to lead on green tech, and now you've got Trump's EPA run by a coal lobbyist, a guy who ridiculed renewable energy. We could have been the leader in battery and solar. No, because there's no real national investment strategy here. Just tax cuts for billionaires and, well, everybody else, figure it out. You'll figure it out. And companies see the writing on the wall, understand that. They invest in China, partnership with European firms, and moving R&D away from here to places that actually care. I look at Trump's transactional attitudes, and our allies, they're not coming along. When we shake down our friends, abandon treaties, and slow walk support for democracies, China's going to step in, and they're going to write new rules. They're going to offer bailouts instead of shakedowns. Our pullback from the global market only leaves it open for Xi Jinping and China. And that soft power that we used to have, the American universities that everyone wanted to come to, a media structure that was free and open, sort of, tech giants who shaped hearts and minds, all that under Trump has been, well, in trouble. Because we're gonna attack immigrants. We're going to demonize people who want to come here and study. We're gonna shut our doors. And China, for all its faults, they see the opportunity. They're signing everything up. They're grabbing everything we're leaving behind. And understand, the verdict, what's it going to be? Well, we're gonna see our innovation wither. Our alliances will fray. Democracy's credibility is going to take a hit. And the world's authoritarian capitalists, well, they're going to get a masterclass on how to step into power vacuums. Our image abroad sits at historic lows. That's Trump's doing. This is the cost of shaking down our allies instead of building coalitions, boasting about winning trade wars as we're losing entire industries, holding summits for TV ratings while China's locking up strategic minerals, supply chains, water rights. In this country, we used to dream big, invest big, lead big. Yet under Trump, what do we have? A forfeiture of the future in real time. And every minute we treat the world leadership like a reality show, China's cashing another check. That's what failing to lead on the global stage looks like. And the void that will be left is going to be filled by Beijing. So we're going to see the Beijing vision, not Washington, not yours, not ours. And for a generation like mine that is used to being the leader globally, that's going to be a tough pill to swallow. So as we hand over the future, and think about that, we're the country who, the space race, we're the country that invested, innovated, pushed technological bounds. And yet for one guy's ego, for one guy's message of how wonderful, for what will be his legacy, we're giving up the future. And not just the future of industry or jobs or technology, but the future of democracy. Because you're giving it up to a Chinese dictator. Think about that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are we worried? I know I am. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
This day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day that the NFL Players Association went out on strike. The American Football League and the National Football League officially merged that year. Each league had their own players' association. With the league merger, they joined forces into one union. The players elected John Mackey, a tight end with the Baltimore Colts, their first president. Frustrated by pay and lack of control over their careers, the players voted to strike. The strike lasted for 2 days. The owners threatened to cancel the season. The NFL used its powerful PR machine to vilify the players in the press. They characterized the players as greedy and stoked fan anger over the walkout. The two sides met again at the bargaining table and reached a collective bargaining agreement. The agreement covered 4 years. The players won improvements to their pensions and dental care. They also secured the right to have agent representation for the first time. But many of the disagreements over pay and control remained unsettled. In 1974, the players were back out on the picket line for 5 weeks during the summer. 8 years later, a 57-day strike disrupted the season. 7 weeks of games were canceled. Then again, 5 years later, the union went on strike during the season. This time, some of the players crossed the picket lines, including stars like Joe Montana and Lawrence Taylor. This broke the strike without settling on a contract. Today, the NFL Players Association continues to push for improved player safety and revenue sharing. The impact of concussions on players' long-term health remains an important issue for the union. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, we've been talking about the one big, beautiful nightmare bill, or the whatever bill, where we've made inequality worse in this country. We've given more to our billionaires and, well, literally taking food out of the mouths of children. And while it's going to make the economy, I think, that much worse for working people, what's it going to do to the planet? And that's one of the big questions. How much worse can we possibly make the climate problem? Well, here to share some thoughts on, well, just how inequality plays into all of that and how our billionaire class not helping. That's why I've asked Chuck Collins to come share some thoughts. He's the director of the Project on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Also, got a new book coming out fairly soon, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and the Planet. Chuck, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be with you, Rick.
So I love the way you start off the new book. The idea that 300 big yachts, 300 big boats owned by our billionaire folks emit as much CO2 as 10 million people in Burundi. Is that reality? Is that true?
That's the reality. The billionaires are the super emitters between their yachts, their private jets, and these multiple $10,000 homes. They are the biggest polluters on the planet. And you know, I think we all are waking up to the impact of climate change and think, well, each of us has to play our part. But some people are like riding bicycles or driving small cars, and other people are driving private jets. It's very unequal. And the billionaires are the biggest polluters
we're dealing with. Do you think that the average person this matters? Do you think these kind of symbols, do you think this kind of example, do you think it matters?
Well, I think it matters because, you know, I think we're, you know, to the extent people realize there's climate change, you know, everybody's saying, well, you should give up blah, blah, or you should give up a hamburger, or you should walk and not drive. And it's like, wait, we're going to make sacrifices and the billionaires are going to keep jetting around. It's offensive. You know, the billionaires are the ones that are going to have to make the biggest changes in their lifestyle so that the planet can survive. We all need to work together, but that's the reality. The other thing is, there are a group of, I call them the fossil fuel oil garks. Those are the ones who are using their wealth and power to block alternatives, to rig the rules, to reopen, keep coal plants open when everybody knows that they should be closed down. The ratepayers shouldn't have to pay for expensive coal. The environmental cost is high. You know, it's only because the coal industry and the fossil fuel industry has lobbied to block the alternatives and run out the clock. So that's a subgroup of billionaires that are really wrecking the planet and making it risking livability for the rest of us.
Now, you argue that the myth of a meritocracy, because we've been told this, you know, this whole meritocracy thing, you argue that this has enabled and really justified the kind of extreme inequality that we're living under. What are some of the most pervasive myths Americans believe about wealth, and how do these narratives reinforced in culture and in our political system?
Well, it's a really important question. You know, I think what's the story that justifies that great concentration of wealth? And, you know, some people say, well, they deserve it, or they worked hard, or they took risks. And a lot of the billionaires promote those stories about their humble origins and how hard they worked and why they deserve all this wealth. And that is, you know, there's a little bit of truth in that, you know, yeah, what you and I do every day matters. And if we work or whether we stay home, whatever. But when it comes to some of these billionaire fortunes, you know, they have that wealth because they've cornered the market, because they've underpaid workers and overpaid themselves, how they've, you know, captured and built monopolies. So the myth of deservedness needs to be interrogated and looked at, you know, because that's what's justifying these inequalities. And we say, look, we all contribute to creating a society where there's a fertile ground for economic activity. And some people do very well and make a lot of money and others don't. We're all in this together. And I think that myth is really harmful.
Yeah, I argue that inequality, the massive wealth inequality that we're suffering under, actually, while we're enriching the folks at the top, is costing a lot more for people at the bottom. And I got to wonder, in your research, have you found ways where billionaire wealth actually raises costs, increased burdens for average everyday working people? Anything from taxes to housing to infrastructure? Are there any concrete examples of that?
Well, I think you can pretty much pick any area of the economy and see how billionaire concentrated wealth is disrupting and raising the cost for ordinary people. Let's just take healthcare, which has become the site of wealth extraction for the billionaire private equity funds. They're moving in to buy up emergency rooms, medical specialties, ambulance and building services. They're looking at healthcare and hospitals and medical services as a profit center. And so that raises the cost for all of us. Housing, the billionaires are driving up the cost of land and housing. Their billionaire private equity funds, again, are buying up rental housing, mobile home parks, single family homes, and raising up those costs and making the cost of housing higher for everybody. So I would argue the billionaires are really harming us everywhere we live. You know, they're robbing your voice and your vote. They're raising the cost of food, the cost of living, and ruining the quality of life for the rest of us.
In your book, Burned by Billionaires, you make the assertion that the ultra wealthy are not only influencing but hijacking the political process. How outside of just writing big campaign checks, How do you argue that they're have hijacked the system, or how it plays in their favor?
Yeah, I think the billionaires are sort of essentially capturing the media environment, the political system, obviously who gets elected, but also what laws pass or what doesn't pass. One of the research shows that billionaires are doing a great job blocking reforms like raising the minimum wage. Things that are wildly popular for the wider public, the billionaires use their power to block the changes they don't want. So all along the way, who runs for election, who's able to, who you know, what legislation moves, what doesn't happen, all that, our political system has been captured by the billionaires.
Yeah.
And you know, that you mentioned the big, the so-called big, beautiful bill, BBB, I like to call it burned by billionaires. That is a case study of oligarchy in action, wealth and power in action, enacting legislation in their interests.
Now, like I said, you know, at the beginning, we made the example of the yachts and that making, you know, the climate worse. Are there other examples of how the ultra rich use their power to stop maybe climate legislation, to influence ideology and narratives? Because look, I've got friends who are like, oh, they've bought that climate change doesn't exist. There's no such thing. It's a liberal hoax. They've bought into all of those frames that our mainstream corporate controlled media seems to fiddle with, and the right wing has completely dove into. How do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, the billionaires and the oil garks have invested so much money in changing the conversation. I mean, up till 2007, you know, George W. Bush was president. He had, you know, members of his cabinet who were supported and believed in climate change, were trying to address it. The U.S. was part of Global Treaties. All that's changed because the fossil fuel industry said, we're going to exercise our power and block our U.S. participation and block action. So, you know, and if you look at something simple like private jets, you know, private jets pollute 20, 30 times more than a passenger on a commercial flight. And yet we subsidize private jets. They don't pay their fair share of taxes. They don't pay their fair share of cost of maintaining the airspace. They're the super polluters. And Congress just passed, as part of the big ugly bill, the big grift, another tax break for private jet purchases. So that's just an example how the rest of us have to pay for the profligate lifestyles of the rich.
All the while not investing in public transit, something that could really help with the climate fight.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, our view is, hey, tax private jet fuel and invest in ground transportation that moves everybody, that creates better systems for the wider population. You know, the fact that we're prioritizing private jets over, you know, rapid bus transit and light rail and all these things just shows how the billionaires dominate our political priorities.
It comes back to the money, doesn't it? In your view, what's the most misunderstood bit of misinformation out there that the general public has you know, kind of, you know, grabbed onto? I mean, there's tons of misinformation, disinformation, and just flat out lies. In your view, what's the most misunderstood part of all of this?
In some ways, it's what we were talking about, that the wealthy deserve this wealth. And what we don't understand is we are living in a period of extreme inequality. And we're kind of in what I would call it the sort of oligarchy doom cycle. Wealth concentrates, the wealthy use their wealth and power to rig the rules of the economy to get more wealth and more power. And it keeps getting worse and worse. It's a spiral. And so using their wealth in this case to disseminate propaganda. You know, there is no climate problem. The wealthy deserve everything. We should exalt them. We should give them more tax breaks. We should give their corporations more tax breaks. So we're in a period of hyper extraction where the super rich are now preying on the rest of the real economy to grab more money.
And I would throw in there as well, Chuck, the biggest one of all is, hey, you could be there too. You could someday, if you just work hard enough, Chuck. Well, maybe not you, because you've done pretty well. But the rest of us, us working stiffs who get up every day, punch a clock to earn enough money just to keep a roof over our head, we're told, hey, if we just work harder, dig a little bit deeper, we could be there too.
Yeah, and that's the other cruel hoax is, you know, social mobility, the opportunity for non-rich people to become wealthy or even just have decent lives has been sacrificed in this process. If you want to live the American dream, you're better off living in Canada or Europe. If you're not born wealthy or you don't have a lot of wealth, you're better off living in a society that still makes investments in education and opportunity and social mobility and opportunities for non-rich people to have decent lives. The United States is no longer the opportunity society for the American dreams, and it's because of these extreme inequalities of wealth and power.
Yeah, but we're told if we give rich people all the money, they're smart, they know what to do with it. And I argue they are smart, they do know what to do with it. They make themselves more money. It doesn't seem to trickle down. And even when they're philanthropic or maybe even a little benevolent, and there are some folks out there who are a little benevolent, they set up foundations and charities, but those seem to always fall short. And I've argued, look, Bezos, Musk, those folks could end homelessness. They could end hunger. They could have real legacies. They just don't choose to.
Yeah, no, you know, we just did a study on the Giving Pledge, which is, you know, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett started this effort to organize billionaires. They now have like 260 billionaires around the world who've pledged to give away half of their wealth in their lifetime. And we've, you know, just turns 15, right, this month. And 15 years later, you would think that if people took that pledge, they would have less wealth. But actually, their wealth is doubled. And in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, his wealth has gone up 4,000%. These are the people who said they're going to give away half of it at least. So their wealth is growing so fast that they're not even addressing, you know, they're not moving the money to solve the urgent problems of our time. So yeah. We can't wait for the billionaires to voluntarily give their money away. We need to tax it and invest it as in a democratic system.
Yeah, well, there's a story not too long ago I read of Mackenzie Scott, Bezos' ex-wife, who literally couldn't give it away fast enough as it was increasing. So she's giving away, and it's still going up because, well, that's just their fortune at the expense of others. Or is it that way? Or is it just, hey, they're just lucky and, well, the rest of you aren't?
No, the economy has now been rigged to funnel wealth to the top. And so even the billionaires who, like Mackenzie Scott, are saying, I want to empty the vault, which she's aggressively doing. She's probably given away $15 billion. You know, she started with 30, she gave away 15, and now she has like 50. You know, the wealth just keeps multiplying. So even if with the best of intentions, the wealth is not moving to meet the urgent needs in our communities. And she's a good example of doing the right thing, but most of them are just seeing their wealth catapult. And so we're probably going to see 15, 20 years from now, these giant dynastic billionaire fortunes that will be in charities, philanthropies. But that's a form of private power where the billionaires are deciding where the money goes. They get to play God with it. Yeah. So that isn't the answer. That doesn't move us in the right direction.
So let me ask you the last kind of line of questioning I've got, because in the new book, Burned by Billionaires, and I hope folks will run out and find it and pick it up. And I don't want to give away the ending and all the stuff in it, but you propose some pathways to reclaiming shared prosperity and democracy and those things. What are a few that you view as the most urgent or effective policies that could get us there?
Well, I think we need to look at things that both reduce the concentration of wealth and pay for the things that we need. So, yeah, tax, private jet fuel, and invest in public transit. Tax inherited wealth and invest in education. You know, link things and build movements where people can see, oh yeah, the spending is making a difference. Healthcare, we should just be outright banning private equity from buying hospitals. You know, most hospitals 80 years ago were owned by charities and religious orders. They had a civic mission. Now more and more hospitals are being bought up by people whose goal is to make money. So we need to protect the services and the parts of the economy from the predators, from the wealth extractors around us. So, you know, I think ultimately taxing the wealthy, but then investing in things that create opportunity for everybody. That was the formula after World War II. And that needs to be the formula going forward.
No, I'm right there with you. And I think tax the rich is a great line. And I know a bunch of people who are, I know some labor leaders who wore T-shirts. I know some of your wealthy friends. You know, guys written a book, Morris Pearl and the Patriotic Millionaires wrote a book on this. It seems sane, seems rational, seems like something the voting populace of this country could get behind, but we don't seem to be able to get there.
Yeah, I mean, here, essentially, 70% of the population supports making sure the rich pay their fair share of taxes. It's a great example where the wealthy are able to block our political system. So we should be looking at the state and local level, where can we levy millionaire taxes in states, have that pay for, as we did in Massachusetts, we passed the Fair Share Amendment, tax on income over $1 million going to transportation and education. That's being replicated in a lot of states, but ultimately it needs to be at the federal level. And we just got to keep putting pressure, building the pressure. It's hard to imagine it this year, but I actually think the pendulum will swing and we will see that happen.
There you go. The book Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and the Planet, written by Chuck Collins. Chuck, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you guys do over there at the Institute for Policy Studies. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Appreciate the time. Want to hear your thoughts. Good ideas? Are you in favor of taxing the very wealthy? Or do you think someday, if I just work a little harder, someday I could get there too? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
The Tap. As Wisconsin is summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy for tonight, some areas of smoke and lows in the mid-50s. For tomorrow, filtered sunshine again from the smoky areas and highs in the mid-70s. Nice Saturday and Sunday. Weekend, 75 to 80 with sun. Currently at 64 degrees.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
NFL Hall of Famer, College Football Hall of Famer, Mr. Joe Thomas. You were telling us a little bit about being drafted number 3. You skipped the draft.
I went fishing that day, and I never did it for anything other than I just much rather spend the day fishing with my dad, and I'm hoping that that's a story that keeps being told and gives people a reason. Like, you know what, instead of working today, I'm going to go fishing with my kid. I'm going to make the time because it's impactful. It's memories that they're going to remember for the rest of their life.
The Todd Allbaugh Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, Chuck Grassley is a little miffed. A little upset at the president. Now, understand, Chuck is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And, you know, he's the guy who, evidently, he's been holding Trump's nominees up, I guess. There's this thing called the blue slip. It's been around for as long as I've ever known. And it kind of slows down the process of putting people on the court. And argue good, bad. Evidently, the president's been really putting it to Chuck Grassley to get rid of this and to basically steamroll over Democrats. And, Grassley said, I was surprised to see President Trump on Truth Social go after me and Senate Republicans over what we call the blue slip. He said, I was offended by what the president said, and I'm disappointed that it would result in personal insult. Chuck, where you been? And here to share some thoughts on, where Chuck's been and, what this blue slip thing is and what it all means, I've asked my good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones, to come share some thoughts. Doug, I'm sure, has some thoughts on the blue slip, on, Trump steamrolling over someone and maybe even Chuck Grassley. Chuck, thanks for taking time for us.
I mean, my Doug. Pleasure. No, I'm not Chuck, but that's fine. I'm not quite that old, Rick, but it's great to be with you again, buddy.
So walk me through, what is this blue slip thing? Walk us through it. Why did they want to get rid of it? And really, is Grassley holding up Trump's nominees?
No, it's not Grassley, but the blue slip can hold up nominees. The blue slip is actually not a rule. It is a more or less an informal kind of tradition that the Judiciary Committee has had for many, many years, in which a home state senator, either any one of the two home state senators, doesn't have to be both, can hold up a nominee for either a U.S. attorney, a U.S. marshal, or a district judge. It does not apply to court of appeals judges or anything like that. It just applies to state, to individual state. And my video here is going nuts. what it is essentially when the president makes a nomination and it goes to judiciary, the chairman of judiciary will send a letter, a blue slip, to the home state senators and said, do you approve with us just moving forward with this nomination? And you can return that, the senator can return that blue slip. It is a home state prerogative. They can return the blue slip and either give a positive recommendation, a negative recommendation, or no recommendation, but they've got to return it in order for the process to proceed. If that is just not returned, if the senator just sits on that blue slip and doesn't return it, then you just Judiciary Committee does not have a hearing. They don't hold hearings. There's never a vote. It never comes to the floor. So it's the blue slip process, but it's actually the home state senators that do that. And Rick, it's been used both ways.
Sure.
I mean, it's not just Democrats that are holding these nominees. Now, in Alabama, under the Trump administration, we had a vacancy in our district court that was vacant for 4 years, the entire time that Joe Biden was president. And our senators would not send in their blue slip. We never had a presidentially nominated and confirmed U.S. attorney in the three districts in Alabama because we could not get agreement for them to send in the blue slips on some very, very good and very qualified nominees. So that's the holdup. It's not Chuck, but Chuck does hold the key to whether or not that process, the blue slip process, remains or not.
So do you think he'll acquiesce? Do you think the blue slip goes the way of the dinosaur? Or do you think Grassley holds up?
I think there's going to be a lot of pressure. What Donald Trump is trying to do is to really pack the courts. You know, the downside to the blue slip process, in my opinion, is that we're turning our judiciary into a red and blue judiciary. Only kind of real conservative Republican judges are getting appointed in states that supported the president, in this case, President Trump, in red states. And in blue states, it's only the Democratic appointees that are getting through. That's not healthy. I've never been really a fan of the blue slip. And I try to like, but it gets, it's been used by both parties.
Sure.
To do it. I know that in the first Trump administration, there were several senators who refused to send in a blue slip on any nominee that Donald Trump set up.
Just like you said, as they did to Biden. So you're right. So you're okay with it going away?
I quite frankly have been okay for a time, you know, to do that. I hate to see something like that go away, but it's truly been weaponized. I think I soured on it more when I tried, and I was not in the Senate, but I tried to get the U.S. senators from Alabama to work with Congresswoman Terry Sewell to just have U.S. attorneys, okay, just to get the U.S. attorneys. But they insisted there was one or two that they wanted, and that's not their prerogative, their advice and consent. They don't get to select. And we've had that happen. When I got to the Senate, Rick, that our two U.S. senators before I got there had withheld blue slips on nominees for the federal bench. There were like a whole slew. There were like five that I voted on because Senator Grassley said that my predecessor, not Jeff Sessions, but Luther Strange, had sent his blue slips in. Some of those had been vacant for 3, 4, and 5 years, and that's just not right. I think one of the votes I cast as a protest vote in the Senate was against a Trump nominee to the Court of Appeals that had been open for about 9 years because Senator Johnson from Wisconsin refused to allow a nominee. So it's been abused. I don't like any rule that gets abused, and
right,
that rule has been abused. So I hate to see the nominees that Trump would appoint in a state like Alabama, especially with a 53-47 majority, because that means just about any judge can get through, a la M.L. Bovee. If that guy can get through the U.S. Senate, then anybody can get through.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and again, I agree with you. All these things seem to be weaponized, things that were supposed to, to kind of level off and not have the extremes of the extremes, we are now using to only ensure that the most extreme people get in. And I'm struggling with that as well. But here's the thing. I keep reading reports that, you know, Republicans in the Senate are ready to do away with all this stuff and, you know, let the steamroller begin. And that's on a number of levels. And I've heard people saying that maybe the filibuster goes the way as well. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I'm worried that all of that will. A couple of years ago, when Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema were given a hard time by a lot of mainstream Democrats out there because they insisted on keeping this filibuster rule, one of their things was that, you know, look, this can turn on you. This can turn quickly. Yeah, you can do this, but we don't want to see the back and forth from one to the other that would create. And everybody knew that the odds were that if Republicans gained control of the Senate again, then they would move to remove the filibuster. That is, I don't think that would have happened necessarily, Rick, if the House had remained Democratic. But with both houses of Congress, you know, the president is about to run into a buzzsaw a little bit with regard to his agenda and his legislation, because if it takes 60 votes as opposed to just 50 in which J.D. Vance could break a tie, that makes a big difference. And I have said all along that I believe that Trump was going to put pressure on John Thune to change the rules, to do the things, to ram through his whatever he wants to do, just like he's ramming through whatever he wants to do in the executive branch. And I fear for the institution if that happens.
I got to get your thought on Tuesday, Cory Booker. The media spun it as he exploded into a rant, but he was pretty straightforward, you know, wanting Democrats to fight back a little bit. He said there's a lot of us in this caucus that want a blanking fight. And what's bothering me right now is we don't see enough fight in this caucus. Are you seeing Democrats, you know, putting up a resistance to the steamroller that has been Trump and the Republicans, given the fact that Trump's, you know, basically ruling by edict every executive order under the sun? Now we've got religious freedom, meaning proselytizing at the DMV. Any thoughts on Booker's statement?
You know, look, I understand Corey's frustration. And in fact, the one thing he got very frustrated at is that New Jersey was not included with some police funding or something along those lines, whereas Minnesota and Senator Klobuchar in Nevada with Senator Cortez Masto was included. There was a frustration level to that. And I get that. I understand that. At the same time, every senator represents their own state, and they've got to do some things that they believe are in their state's interest. And you can't just oppose for everything that's going on. You've got to do things that you believe are good for your constituencies and good for the country. And that's not always going to oppose. And sometimes some people are going to get left out. I totally understand the frustration, and I am, you know, look, I'm a big fan of Corey's, but at the same time, this can't be unified opposition to everything that Donald Trump is doing. Not everything he's doing is going to hurt folks in Alabama or other states. And that's who the senators represent,
right,
as well. And they can do that and not compromise principles on the bigger issues of government.
Well, to put you on the spot, I'm sure everyone out there is going, okay, well, if there are things that Trump's doing that would help, well, let us know. Because, you know, I'm looking at a lot of the things that Trump has moved on that I'm seriously not thrilled with. And ideologically, a lot of it I'm opposed to. Taking money out of programs that help our veterans, food out of the mouths of children so we can make
absolutely
a wealthier wealth class. I'm adamantly opposed. And I don't know how you move forward on that.
No, you don't, Rick. And if you look back, that's the thing. Democrats have universally opposed that. Every Democrat in the Senate opposed Trey Yeager says, the bill, the big, bad bill. They opposed all of those things. Democrats have been in lockstep opposing those kind of things that go against the Democratic values, go against that they believe hurt their states, hurt this country. But it's not always universal. It doesn't have to be. And I don't think that everybody needs to look at every issue and simply say, you know, that I'm going to oppose it just because Trump's doing it.
Right.
I don't think I think that's shirking the duties of a United States senator.
Yeah, generally,
but the fact of the matter is, The fact of the matter is almost, I would say probably 98% of what he's doing so far, Democrats have universally opposed because it does hurt the country.
No,
and it does hurt every state in the union.
Because look, for me, I'm looking at what Trump is doing. And if I'm in the Senate, I don't want to normalize how bad this has been by going, oh, we can work together on these things and these things. No, you've got to stop what you're doing. For instance, I just saw a story. They're going to investigate Comcast. And I'm not a Comcast fan. I'm not a supporter. I think they're too big to exist. I think we've allowed these media companies to get too big. But this isn't what they're investigating for. They've launched a formal inquiry into Comcast and NBC Universal because evidently there's something about how they treat local broadcast affiliates. And you know it's going to come back to how they were covering Trump. But it's all of these people getting shook down, whether it's the law firms, whether it's at Harvard and Columbia or universities. It's all of this. I don't know how you can, to me, I don't want to normalize that and think, oh, you know, hey, we can just disagree on these issues. I think there's got to be a united front against what he's doing.
No, I agree that on the issues that are like that. But that's an issue by issue basis to me. I don't think that you can get a blanket statement when you don't know what he's going to do next and say, I'm going to oppose everything that he does. There may be things that he and others on the Senate floor put forward. I don't see them right now, okay? And I don't know the details of what it was that Corey was talking about. I haven't seen anything just yet. All I've seen is the horrible bullying that he does from the Oval Office. I'm seeing the reconciliation bill that I think was horrible, that's going to increase by trillions of dollars. We've got an appropriations process, though, that the Senate and the should traditionally have worked on. That was the biggest problem in the rescission package, okay? That we're in a position now that Democrats are being put in a position to not even cooperate on everything that has been traditionally left to the Senate and the Congress on appropriations, because you don't know if you agree with somebody and you pass it, that they're not going to come in 3 months and say, oh, I'm sorry, Donald Trump didn't like that, so we need to rescind it. He's putting Democrats in a very difficult position, but I don't think you compromise anything by looking at every issue as it comes up. You may look at it with the presumption that you're going to oppose it, but I think the duty of a United States senator, Rick, is to keep somewhat of an open mind on every issue that comes before them, and then weigh that and weigh the exact same things that you're talking about, and then make a decision.
Yeah, I don't entirely disagree. In theory, I'm right there with you. But again, the rage, I probably belong more in the House than the Senate with the rages of the people, you know, fired inside of me. But, you know, Booker's, you know, as you pointed out with Booker's concern is, you know, the money was going to New Jersey and not going to New Jersey, but going to places that people had supported. So for me, in looking at this, this is another example of Trump's, enriching those who are the loyal. And if you're disloyal, well, you're going to be left out in the cold. This is something that Joe Biden did not do. Most of the investments that were made through his, the energy plans, for instance, went to red states. He from where I sit, did not appear to be a ruler, a leader in this kind of fashion. Whereas Donald Trump, it's very, very transactional.
No, totally agree with that. The interesting piece of that is that the things that he tried to do, Joe Biden did, with infrastructure, with his Build Back Better bill, within the investments he was putting, they primarily went into red states because it was the red states that have not received this. They've been so conservative. They've not done anything. They needed those investments. And we were just hoping that these investments would spur the fact that Democrats are looking out for people. And they didn't get that message out to do that. But at the same time, you know, look, I don't think anybody can accuse Amy Klobuchar and Catherine Cortez Masto of being Trump loyalists.
No, but okay. I'm not saying they're loyalists. They came along. They went along.
They went along on a specific bill, right, that they saw some things that would, Donald Trump didn't need them. They didn't need those two votes to pass that. It was something that they ended up agreeing to. And I understand the frustration, but I'm not sure I completely agree with it because of that particular issue as opposed to the others that are going to go dramatically affect people.
Well, I mean, for me, the message out of this then would be if a Democrat takes over in 28, maybe this is the way the Democrats are going to starve red states for being not on board. I mean, this is what frightens me.
You think that's going to be good for me?
No.
In Alabama?
No. It's good for the country.
I mean, that's the point. I don't want to give up on the red state voters, for God's sakes.
Right.
I mean, and that's what you're doing. You're not giving up on red states. You're giving up on their voters. And you're going to hurt those people, even though it may be only 40% of those people. You're going to hurt a lot of folks by doing that. And I don't like the red states get richer or the blue states get richer. Senators have to look out for their own constituencies. There is a bigger picture, but they have to look out for their constituencies. Look, Rick, the one thing that you and I can agree on, I think for sure, is that we're in getting in a deep hole when it comes to our institutions of government and protecting our democracy. There is nothing that I'm seeing coming out of this administration that is any way democratic, that is any way looking out for the most of the people in society. He did not have a huge mandate at all. And he is hurting people across the board and is going to end up hurting red states a lot more than he's helping red states.
No, I'm right there with you. Finally, I got one more. And you know where we got to go here. The Epstein thing has taken a lot of oxygen out of the air. I know they're on either side. There's a lot. My red hat friends are really ticked at Trump for not getting Bill Clinton's head on a platter, for instance. I know my friends on the left are angry because they believe, as I do, Trump's name's all over it. I want to hear your thoughts. You're probably one of the most level-headed, sane, rational people I know. Where are we? What should we know?
You know, look, Rick, the first and foremost, this should not be an issue that is so politically charged. It should not be that the MAGA crowd wants these files released because they think it's a bunch of Democratic elites that are going to get caught up in it and get prosecuted. Democrats should not want these files released because they think Donald Trump's name is in it and he's going to get caught up in this. What we should be seeing is more transparency because this was horrific crimes against children, against young women who were trafficked, who were abused, and regardless of the political consequences, those files should be released. And what we're seeing out of this administration right now is just simply digging themselves in a deeper hole. You don't live by conspiracies unless you expect to perhaps die by conspiracies. Okay. And when you have the head of the FBI, the head of the Department of Justice promoting all of this, then they need to come through.
Yep.
And they have made this the big issue. And this whole thing about the grand jury that was just reported today, there's only two witnesses. I've been trying to tell people grand jury testimony is not going to give you the files. It's not going to give you what you want. It's only a summary of testimony of things about Jeffrey Epstein. So forget that. But this is not going away, Rick. Anytime soon. And now you got to wonder whether or not those files exist. I mean, you remember this is a president who took classified information and stuck it in a bathroom down in a Florida resort.
Yeah. No, and what I said from the beginning, Doug, I said, you know, if I'm Trump in this, I don't know why he keeps adding oxygen to this fire. If I'm him, I release everything, go, it's all out there. Yeah, my name's out. I knew the guy. There's videos of me arm in arm with him. It's there. And oh, by the way, then make the, you know, Biden's people did this. If there's some bad stuff. For me, it's always the cover up. It's always the trying to get away from what you did that gets you into more trouble. Just admit you had the affair. Admit you did something. Don't try and keep covering it up. And what you just said, that's a major felony. If those documents were there and are no longer there, someone did that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree with you. The easiest thing, redact it, protect those innocent folks. But right now, everything that the Trump administration is doing is an insult to the victims of that crime. And there were a lot of them, and they deserve better. And the fact that he sent his personal lawyer, who happens to be the number two at the Department of Justice, is just stunning to me. He had no business doing this. He should recuse himself. They should all do that and let somebody else look at this and see, redact what needs to be redacted and put it all out there and let the chips fall where they're going to fall.
Yeah. Does this go anywhere? Do Democrats get all the things released? Or do we end up in kind of a, you know, everyone's unsatisfied by what comes out or if anything comes out?
I think everyone is going to do the going to be no one's going to be satisfied at this point. Even if they were to appoint a special counsel, think about this: who in the hell could they appoint that would have the credibility of everybody? Yeah. Who would have the credibility of Marjorie Taylor Greene and Hakeem Jeffries to do that? That they would have trust in. I don't think there is anyone in this country that could be the special counsel that could do that. So, look, this is not going to go away. I think Democrats are going to keep it in the air and keep moving on it. There was a letter that went out by Senate Democrats today and the Homeland Security Democrats and Senator Schumer. They're going to keep pushing, and they're going to keep this in the news until something gives.
Yeah. I know I said last question, but really quick, where do I send the check for when you're running for president?
Oh, Rick Smith, I think it's time to go, buddy. I think it's time to call it a day. Turn out the lights. The party's over.
There you go. All right. Well, I got to tell you, Doug, as always.
I don't know what that was, Rick.
That was my ears exploding.
Okay. I apologize.
So we'll see you back here next time.
All right, buddy. Thank you.
Thanks so much, our good friend Doug Jones. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, yeah, I'm a big Doug Jones fan, and we could do a lot with a guy like that in the Oval Office. I don't think he's going to run. I think he's got other ideas, other aspirations. And look, the hope is that we get in 2026, people who are going to step forward like Doug and run for House, for Senate, for the governor's mansions. It would be great to see, you know, good people step forward and get the support that working class folks need. My problem, again, I come back to what I talked about with Doug, is the normalization of all of the craziness that Trump has brought us, all of the chaos, all of the overreach, all of the destruction of institution, the creation of instability. And, you know, what I've noticed is people, and I agree with Booker on a certain level. I think most people, they're just kind of going, I just want the pain to stop. I just want a break. I don't need it. And the hope is that we wake up to the reality that what Trump is doing is normalizing fascistic behavior. The destruction of all of those checks and balances that were in our system so that extremism didn't take over, all being wiped away. And again, it's by the people who told us they believe in freedom and liberty and states' rights and, well, all of that. I hope we begin to wake up. I want to hear your thoughts. What are you seeing? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Just hours before the self-imposed midnight deadline, President Trump signs an executive order listing out tariff rates for imports from dozens of countries starting next week. While so many Canadians are refusing to shop from or travel to the U.S. over tariffs in Toronto, CBS's Chris Mavridi says a lot of Americans have figured out that there are some pretty sweet deals to be had north of the border.
Not just from a higher than usual exchange rate, which has made hotels and restaurants more affordable to American travelers, but some of the big international chain stores are now selling clothing and shoes cheaper here, since a lot of that stuff is made in countries that are now tariffed by the U.S., but not by Canada.
A White House official tells CBS News the just-announced extra 7 days are intended to give Customs and Border Protection enough time to implement the new tariff rates. Pounding rain prompts flash flood watches and warnings along the I-95 corridor from Maryland to